Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guest. In this case, it's Denis Kucinich. He needs no introduction. People may not know, but he started out as a city councilman and the mayor of Cleveland, Ohio, where I first met him. I interviewed him when I was working at the LA Times, and I was very impressed with what he was doing there. We'll get back to that in a bit because he's written a book about his time in Cleveland as mayor and his populist tradition that's important to our discussion. But he spent 16 years in Congress. He ran for the presidency or for the Democratic nomination. And Denis, I want to begin. The reason I called you, the reason we're doing the podcast now, Tuesday, a week after the election, but last Monday, the day before the election, I was talking with you, and you predicted that Trump would certainly carry Ohio, and you thought, you know, it was going to be a much closer. You certainly did not talk about a blue wave overwhelming, and it turned out to be quite tight, particularly in that region that you're in. And he lost Ohio, as you predicted. And I think you even predicted he would lose your old congressional district. So tell us why you thought Trump would be difficult to beat. And what do you think is really the lesson of this election?
I think you have to analyze this in a number of different levels. First of all, you have to look at the economics of Northern Ohio. And, you know, from Lorain County along the lake all the way out to Ashtabula and the Youngstown, Mahoning County area, Trumbull, Columbiana County. This at one point was one of the economic engines of America. It was a center for massive production of steel, automotive, aerospace, large shipping business. And what's happened over the years is there's been a decline, and there's been a decline of population as well. But the people who were most affected by it were working class people who worked in the mills, who worked in the factories that made these goods. And so I think when you start with the trade policies, which created where NAFTA and China trade created a profound economic shift in the Midwest, and particularly in Ohio. You know, what I began to see 4 years ago was working class Democrats starting to move over to the Republicans. In particular, they were ready to support Donald Trump's candidacy because they felt there was a breach of faith. And so I think that right now we have to analyze the election on one level, which is economic, the impact of trade policies. And beyond that, the fact that when there was this bailout on Wall Street in 2008, 2009, after the subprime meltdown, there are parts of Cleveland that never recovered from that period. There were, you know, thousands and thousands of homes that were lost. There were people who have very bitter memories of that period. And they don't feel that the Democratic Party was representing them, so that's what accounts for this difference in the in the vote that President Obama received in 2008, and then again in 12, and the vote that Joe Biden received in these areas. And the strength that President Trump had among working class Democrats, who many of whom switched parties. And these were part of my old constituents. So, you know, as a Democrat, I look at that and I say, whoa, somebody better start paying attention to this. What is that? You know, how does that translate into the Biden administration?
It goes back to Hillary as well.
Yeah,
the 16 election, and you know, this trade policy, Bill Clinton had a lot to do with that trade policy. NAFTA was on his watch, after all. And you know, one could argue that in the rewrite of NAFTA, you know, there's actually some concessions to labor. I would argue it's actually a better agreement that Trump negotiated than Clinton did. I don't think that it has registered on much of the media that has covered this.
Well, as, you know, traditionally, with the exception of some of the trades, you know, unions have gone with Democrats, but the Democrats haven't always delivered. And so it's the rank and file in some of the unions, there's been a disconnect between the leadership and the rank and file based on economics. Not some people will say it's social issues. Not so much. It's based on economics. And because that the economic issues, if you go back to the old New Deal coalition where FDR brought in this big Democratic Congress in 1932, you understand that he had a mandate to create a tremendous change, most of which were, you know, was about job creation and about rebuilding America. The victory by Joe Biden does not carry with it this kind of mandate. As a matter of fact, we have a country that's more polarized than ever. It's I think it's very important in his remarks in Delaware the other day that he talked about healing, but he's laboring under this the policies of the congressional Democrats who created this investigation of Russia's alleged interference in the election that was not legitimate from the start, and who pushed an impeachment. And so, you know, these are the kinds of things that are very difficult to be able to find a way to bring people together, because the memories are very bitter, just the same way that Mitch McConnell's treatment of Barack Obama was not aimed at reconciliation. It was hard-nosed politics. And, you know, this is part of what's going on in our country right now. The divisions remain. It's good that President-elect Biden is trying to set the right tone. The Democratic Party must pay close attention to what happened in Ohio as a potential harbinger of what could happen in 2022 and 2024, if it doesn't get back on the economic issues, notwithstanding the pandemic.
So let's talk about the economic issues, because when you watch MSNBC, or even read some of the so-called progressive media in general, it's not about that. The Trump vote, which is 72 million people, or 71 and change as compared to, I guess, 76 for Biden, it's supposed to be rural, it's supposed to be racist, it's supposed to be alienated people, the deplorables that Hillary Clinton referred to. But you're really talking about the base of the Democratic Party for decades in places like Ohio, even in Wisconsin and Michigan that Biden managed to win. It was by small margins. And, in Wisconsin, I think it's just a flip of less than 30,000 votes or something that changed it. But the normal blue wall that they used to refer to, including even that it should be as close as it was in Pennsylvania,
right,
is an indication that this is not just, rural people who don't have enough education, et cetera, but this is really was the heart of the Democratic Party in the North. And you're suggesting that it's kind of permanently lost or dismayed, and we're talking about your the reason this conversation is important, as far as I'm concerned, these are your people. These are the people who put you in as mayor of Cleveland.
Right.
These are the people who sent you to Congress for 16 years. You only lost your seat because your district was gerrymandered and you in order to drive you out. But we're talking about really what used to be the base of the Democratic Party. And so put it in Britain and give us the nuts and bolts of it. I mean, what do people tell you when you talk to these Democrats who could turn to Trump?
Well, that that they didn't leave the party left them. And I see this as, you know, this is something I warned about over the years. If the party didn't adequately address the underlying changes in the economy that were occurring because of trade, which is in the knock-on effect, not only in the big industries, but the small machine shops and, you know, smaller businesses, which created also a substantial number of jobs, that would happen is there was a hollowing out that occurred. And it's reflected also in the shift of congressional districts out of Ohio and towards the South and West. And, you know, most of the Northeast is the growth is in the country, and the growth in the country is in the South, in the West and the South. And so what's happening is that the party made book with corporations more than 30 years ago.
You're talking about the Democratic Party.
Yeah, the Democratic Party made book with corporations. The differences began to be blurred. The policy considerations were similarly blurred. And the constituency, which really built the Democratic Party, which was the people who came out of the industrial areas across the country, notably, you know, in the Midwest where I'm from, you know, they started to see the quality of their life slipping. And while they either saw rising unemployment or falling wages or pension benefits begin to slip away, the inability to be able to send their kids to school, their kids ending up in massive debt to be, you know, able to complete a college education, not having any opening in the economy once they complete a college education. People look at that and they go, wait a minute, why is this happening? And the burden, for the most part, has fallen on the Democratic Party. When President Obama took office, he had an opportunity where he had a Democratic House and Senate for, you know, at least 2 years, and the potential of being able to change the trade agreements to put workers' rights, human rights, environmental quality principles in there. That didn't happen. The other thing is the Democratic Party not presenting an effective opposition on foreign policy. And, you know, we were dragged into one war after another, which claimed hundreds of billions of dollars in resources, actually trillions of dollars in resources. And the sacrifice was felt in one city after city. We don't have an urban policy to speak of. You rarely heard cities mentioned in this election. The emphasis was on the suburbs. You know, that was a good political strategy in one way, but it was bad for the long-term health of the Democratic Party, which is you have to rebuild the urban areas where the vote started. And the only way you can do that is looking at the economics of the country and the people who are just hanging on by their fingernails right now, Bob. It's a very difficult period for many people, you know, in the face of the economy. Before the pandemic, it was coming, it seemed to be coming back, but the pandemic dealt a body blow to not just the American economy, but to those places where people make things and they create things and they distribute things all over the country. I had the head of one of the biggest corporations in America tell me that his company was looking at 2020 as being literally a lost year. So you think of how many people are taking a hit right now. Whatever Congress was able to do in terms of a stimulus or support was minuscule. And check this out. I was frankly very surprised that the Democrats didn't come through before the election and stalled on any kind of a stimulus, because it's the Democratic constituency that really needed help the most. I suppose that congressional Democratic leaders didn't want Trump to have any credit for that. I can understand the politics, but I do not understand the policy, because it actually hurts the very people that Democrats rely on. So this is a, we're at a moment right now, an inflection point, where we've got to pay attention to what happened in this election, what it tells us about where the Democratic Party has been, where it's going. I'll tell you, you know, being able to pick up, like in suburban Cleveland, areas that were traditionally Republican in presidential races, like towns with the names of Bay Village, Rocky River, even Westlake, Ohio, which has a pretty big population, they voted for Biden, surprisingly. However, down ballot, it went Republican. So you've got a so anybody who thinks that this is some kind of a big shift that occurred towards the Democratic Party is misreading the results. You've got to look at where it's been the fall off. I'll give you an example. In the city of Cleveland, the vote in the city of Cleveland on the predominantly in the city of Cleveland overall, the turnout was only 53%. That's abysmally low. There was really not much of a campaign to begin with. They didn't try to inspire people to come out. The Democrats lost Ohio by 8 points in 2016 and lost Ohio by 8 points again in 2020. And the city of Cleveland on the east side, which is predominantly black, the turnout was only 50%. And on the west side, which is a little more Caucasian and mixed, the turnout was 56%. So what you get is an indication that at least with respect to Cleveland, which at one time was one of the leading cities in bringing Democratic turnout, you carry Cleveland, Cuyahoga County by a few hundred thousand votes, you're on your way to winning Ohio. Well, that doesn't exist anymore. And there ought to be real concern about it, because the knockout, there is political fallout from these policies. And every 4 years, we get to do a kind of an audit to see how the party's doing. And the in Ohio, Cleveland, Cuyahoga County, state of Ohio, bad shape.
Time for a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and our guest.
So let me ask you, because the argument you hear, if you talk to people who are very, thought this is really, the Democrats stand for the working people. The first thing they bring up is the Affordable Care Act. And, that was at stake. And that's why then the Supreme Court now might overturn it. And that's the most important thing for working people. And I know you were on the fence about it, because you didn't feel there was a, when you were in Congress, your vote. Well, why don't you tell us about that? You were invited on the presidential plane. Your vote was critical. It was that close in getting the Affordable Care Act passed. And you had reservations, but you went along with it.
Well, I introduced legislation, John Conyers and I introduced legislation to create Medicare for All, a program that would cover everybody in the country. And, at the time, such a program would have cost over $3 trillion, but it's about economic stimulus, it's about a healthy workforce, about a healthy economy, it's about everything that translates into having a country that takes care of its people, and the people then take care of the country. That was my proposal. I campaigned across America on it, and we had about 90 co-sponsors in the House, almost all of them Democrats. And by the time that President Obama came into office, he was looking for this Affordable Care Act, and I was the last holdout. I didn't like it. It didn't. My concern was that it didn't even have a public option. I argued for that strongly. I had 3 meetings at the White House with the president, with increasingly smaller groups. And then I still wasn't sold, because what I saw is there was a chance for the insurance companies to make out like bandits with this. And also the same could be said of the pharmaceutical companies. And I, you know, my constituents in the end wanted to, they wanted the benefits of being able to put their children on their policy to have pre-existing conditions covered and some of the other benefits that went with the Affordable Care Act. And in the end, notwithstanding my own personal misgivings, I, you know, based on my the appeal of my own constituents, I said, okay, you know, I'm a representative. I'm going to represent the people who sent me to Congress. But I had a lot of misgivings, and I expressed them to President Obama. We, you know, we flew to Cleveland on Air Force One. You know, it was a lovely meeting, except he didn't convince me because he was ready to take the whole bill down if he didn't get it exactly as he wanted it. I saw that. I thought it would, you know, that he put so much capital in his position that it could have hurt his presidency. But, you know, in the end, the Affordable Care Act was insufficient to meet the health care needs of the American people. There were still millions of people who weren't being covered. Now, in this election, Joe Biden did say that he would come out for a public option. Let's see if that happens. If he does, that's progress. But I think that the Democratic Party could rebuild the party by taking a strong stand on Medicare for All. After all, think about this, Bob. We're in a pandemic. If you can't stand for Medicare for All in the middle of a pandemic, when in the world can you do that? And so I'm cautiously optimistic that the president-elect, soon to be the president, will stand behind the pledge that he made and rally the congressional Democrats to get it through and see what kind of negotiations can be obtained in the Senate.
But just to set the historical record straight, on that airplane trip with the president, you know, and they needed your vote, I remember Henry Waxman, who was head of the most critical committee and pushing it, he actually asked me about your thinking. And I said, you should talk to Dennis. You got on a plane. Didn't President Obama suggest he would go for some kind of public option?
No, absolutely not. He was opposed to it. And when I, you know, when I got off the plane, I hadn't made any commitment at all. People thought there was some kind of a deal made. Like, what did I get? You know, nothing. But here's the thing. That night, the next day, the president was trying to reach me on my cell phone. I didn't take his call because I heard everything I wanted to hear. I had to think about it. I had to weigh the interests of my constituents with my own concerns about the trajectory of healthcare in America. And, you know, when I mean, and I will tell you the story, Bob, I actually went early in the morning to my church on Capitol Hill, which is at the rotunda of the Capitol, sat down next to Abe Lincoln statue. It was about 7:30 in the morning. The sun was streaming through, and I just sat there thinking about my vote. And, you know, when I was there for about a half hour, 45 minutes, and I decided that I would that I would support it as taking a step in the direction, inevitably the direction of Medicare for All, even though that's not what it was about. That if I was the vote that sent it down, not only would it deny my constituents, but that who were appealing to me personally, but also it would make it ever more difficult to be able to achieve healthcare reform because people would always point to a benchmark of a failed effort. So, you know, I knew it was a critical vote. The president did. I talked to him after I announced that I was going to support it. But, you know, they had no idea how I was going to go in the White House until I actually announced it in a news conference on Capitol Hill, because I wasn't convinced. And the issues that I raised were, you know, still legitimate. I still believe this country is big enough, has enough resources to be able to cover health care for everyone. And I see this as, if the Democratic Party would have got that through, it would have been very difficult to be able to have Republican majorities anywhere for a long, long time.
Well, you know, the conservatives in the party are arguing oppositely. They're saying now you got these two races in Georgia for the Senate that can hang the balance or change the balance, and that the party should stop listening to all this, you know, what they call socialism and all these progressive and so forth. And I mean, you've read that and seen that, and there's the pushback by even a lot of Republicans coming over or claiming they're coming over. And that's really the big battle. And I want to get at the guts of it. One of the things that's not reported widely or noticed, we always talked about election finance reform. We talked about the terrible role of money in destroying democracy. And in this particular election, particularly if you look at the last months, Biden outraised, you know, the campaign money, you know, by an enormous amount over Trump, and he got a lot of it from, you know, the Larry Flink at BlackRock and people like that, from Wall Street, from Silicon Valley, Eric Schmitz, you know, one of the PACs that he gives money to, and so forth, and big money went for Biden. So are the Democrats really? I mean, they're sort of now the party of the financial establishment, are they not?
Well, the evidence points in that direction. The policies that issue forth from the new Congress and the new administration will give a chance to demonstrate that it's not so.
Well, tell me more about that. I mean, are you optimistic? Isn't the party, I mean, didn't it really start with Bill Clinton when he did the financial so-called reform? Well, first of all, he ended the federal anti-poverty program, AFDC, the aid to family with dependent children. He put through the deregulation of Wall Street. He freed these people to do their housing swindles and mortgage-backed derivatives and so forth. You know, this has been going on now for 4 decades. And is there really any possibility that the Democrats are going to break, particularly when they won this election against somebody who should have been a very weak candidate, given a pandemic, among other things? Is there really any chance they're going to deliver on a progressive agenda, which in terms of income inequality would certainly have to face this new billionaire class and the, you know, the incredible centers of wealth in America? Is there really a snowball chance in hell that they would do that?
Let me put it this way. It's November 9th. I've seen times in Cleveland where on November 9th, it was very, very cold, okay? Sub-zero. Close to zero. And other times, today, the temperature is 79 degrees, okay? So I think that, you know, it is possible that those inside the party can recognize, notwithstanding who supported them in the election, that there's an opening here to remake the American compact. And let's see if they do. If history repeats itself and the Democrats will look to their contributors first to decide what the policy of the country should be, then what very well could happen is that you will see a further decline of the party in 2022. I mean, this really is a turning point for the Democratic Party. Joe Biden must know that. I mean, you know, I've known the president-elect since 1972. We both were candidates for Congress then, and I lost by 1.5%, and he won his race in Delaware. And you know, we met then and have known each other over the years, and you know, we've talked. I respect him. He's one of the few people in American politics who can really look at a trajectory of where we're at as a society. And I think that should be a good thing. He's going to have to disappoint some people. I'm just hoping it won't be the people who are living in neighborhoods in Cleveland and in Scranton and in Chicago and in other cities around the country. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answer to that. I don't want to predict that that there's no way that the interest of those who are the working class and middle class people in this country, the shrinking middle class, I might add, that they, I don't want to say their interests are not going to be served, because it's too cynical to say that. I think we have to provide the president-elect, and when he's sworn in, the support that he needs to get an agenda passed, and all those progressives who are not particularly happy, you know, witnessing the landscape the way that you just described, Bob. I think the important thing is to get in there, organize on the floor of the House, and start moving votes. I will tell you this: my experience as a member of Congress has been that the floor of the House of Representatives is a very dynamic place. That you actually can change things there, but you have to really be ready to reach across the aisle, to build relationships, to talk to your colleagues, to show them what the better approach and reason is. Democrats need to talk to Democrats, not just, you know, talk to Republicans. And it's going to be very important for the Democratic majority to listen carefully to the progressives in their midst, because particularly on the economic issues, because I think that there's still this concern that the Democratic Party won't deliver for its constituency. If it does, in terms of wages, benefits, health care, trade policy, rebuilding the infrastructure, creating jobs that way, education, educational opportunities, you know, giving young people a chance to get out of this incredible debt. I mean, these are all things that can reverse the losses that have occurred, because it's, you know, this thing isn't set just yet, but it is a dangerous moment, and the party must make an assessment of why President Trump did so well in areas that were, you know, that have been part of America's heartland.
You know, Dennis, I have a lot of respect for you, but I'm going to push back big time right now, because this is the pie in the sky stuff that has been deluding us for a long, long time. And I'll take you back to your start. You were a young, idealistic guy in Cleveland from a poor working class family. Your family had lived, you know, in a car. I checked out your whole background. I know it quite well. You know, you experienced it. And you came along with a progressive vision. And very early on, as mayor of Cleveland, you ran up against the banks. And whatever the banks said, you know, and it involved a public utility. It involved the people's right to be able to get a decent rate on their electricity and so forth. And you've written a book, which I've read, which is going to come out soon. What's the title of it?
It's called The Division of Light and Power.
The Division of Light and Power. And it was, what was the company? The people. There was a public utility.
Yeah, Muni Light was our public utility. It still exists. It's now called Cleveland Public Power, which at that time, when I was starting my career, was called the Division of Light and Power. So,
yeah.
But you know, I know where you're going. Let me jump ahead.
tell listeners where we're going, because you, a long time ago, and I was there in Cleveland interviewing you and seeing this, you were fighting a fight to keep a public utility in business when the banks wanted to grab it, and they put the city of Cleveland into insolvency in order to grab it. And you fought them back. That was the launch of your political career. Now I'm talking to you 4 decades later, more, and you're telling me that the money that talked in Cleveland will not talk now nationally?
No, I'm not saying that at all, Bob. I never said that. And let me just say that for me personally, my position, my sentiments haven't changed. I'm the same person I was when I started my career 40, 50 years ago. But I'm giving you an assessment. The thing that I don't want to do, and I think it's really important for the country, is not to cast doom and gloom on the election of a Democratic president. I'm not going to do that. I think we have to give him a chance, see if it works. And if it doesn't turn out, then you know, there'll be a challenge. But I think this is the wrong time, absolutely the wrong time, to throw a pall over the election of President elect Biden, even understanding, as I do, as well as you do, how the party again and again has let down working people. You know, hope springs eternal, the poet says. And I think that the progressives, who, you know, whom I count myself, need to regroup, come up with an agenda, fight for it on the floor of the House, and there'll be victories. I have no doubt about that. You've got some very strong, a strong presence in the Congress of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. I mean, they have their own director and policy person and other staffers. It's organized. So let's give Biden a chance to get started and see if he can do it. Now, do I have concerns? Of course I do. But right now, I don't want to go there and tell my friend, who has just ascended to the highest office in the land as a Democrat, that we can't do something. Well, we're going to have to try to make the changes. And it's up to him to show the way. And it's up to the Democrats in Congress to help him and come up with a better reason and a better policy than perhaps the administration would recommend. So, you know, I really think at this time where the votes, you know, where there's still a legally contested race, it seems, and I'm talking as a Clevelander here, as somebody who's talking to you from the same house that I've lived in since 1969. I'm telling you that I want to give our new president a chance and to see if he can try to rework this American compact or consensus for the betterment of the American people. And if he doesn't, there'll be plenty of time to go over that. And I wouldn't hesitate to make an assessment, but you got to give him a chance. I mean, I feel very strongly about that. To do it otherwise is, you know, there's only so much. I've been in politics since 67. And I refuse to be cynical. No matter how much I know, I refuse to be cynical. I still think that we've got to believe that the country will find a way to a better place as we change leaders.
Well, you know, Dennis, ever since I've known you, we've worn different hats. And I'll give you a lot of credit for trying to make the system work and working within the Democratic Party and trying to move it in a progressive direction. And I agree with you. There's a stronger progressive caucus than we've had for a long time. And I agree that there's going to be a lot of pressure to try to get the Democrats to be a truly progressive party. But, you know, as a journalist, my job is to keep a critical eye. And I was fooled by Bill Clinton. I interviewed him before he became president, and I believed he was actually, you know, he got it. He came from a poor background in the South, that he would take the money from wealthy people, but he would, you know, deliver. And the fact is that under Bill Clinton, we had the biggest gifts to Wall Street and the new rich and the new billionaire class that any president has given. The total deregulation of Wall Street in any kind of serious way, and failure to use antitrust with the rise of the dot-coms and everything else. And that's continued. We're now talking about a 40-year history of betrayal of any idea of accountability the Telecommunications Act, the so-called welfare reform, the Financial Services Modernization Act, the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, all of this stuff, the NAFTA, the different trade agreements. And so, yes, give the guy a chance, you know, but what does that mean? Where's the pressure going to come from?
Well,
let me ask you one, then I'll give you all the time you want. There's an element of co-option. You know, you have Trump washing. That guy was so bad. You know, you got to settle for whatever these people dish out. Well, I brought up something much earlier on NAFTA. Actually, the trade agreement that Trump negotiated was an improvement over the one that, the Democrats had. At least there is some guarantee of a decent wage of $16 an hour in Mexico. There's some restraints on what you can bring over. There's some environmental protection. And, you know, another thing, I mean, the point is, how far does lesser evil take you?
Well, here's the thing. I don't think you were fooled by Clinton as much as you wanted to believe that he would deliver on, what he said. And I think that's where a lot of people are with our new president-elect, Joe Biden. They want to believe that he's going to deliver. Unfortunately, this kind of campaign, the chance for articulating those a range of promises was lost, and the positions become a little bit more cryptic than they were a few years ago. But you have to look at you know where Joe Biden comes from. And he does have you know working class roots. I think that you know hopefully he'll remember where he came from, as opposed to where he arrives at today. Now I want to point out something to you, Bob, that I don't think I've ever shared with anybody. But it seems this conversation seems as good of a time as any to be able to reveal this. You know, my congressional seat, which, as you pointed out, was redistricted. It's actually cut up in four pieces and made it impossible for me to win. That redistricting was brought about not by the Republicans, but by the Democrats who in Ohio who insisted that my seat be the one that was lost. And, you know, I don't have any kind of warm and fuzzy feelings for the party per se, not at all. But I do have a commitment to the historic mission of the Democratic Party, which is to lift people's lives up. You know, going, you know, and you can we can point directly to you know the New Deal, to the New Frontier, to the Great Society. You know, these were benchmarks in my life, in the life of my family, and they're part of what defined it to be a Democrat. And within that realm was lifting up people who were infirm and aged, people of color, creating you know civil rights, responding to affirmatively to the civil rights movement. You know, this was there was something about the idea that every American would have an opportunity. Well, you know, that's out the window right now. We need to reclaim it. Will the party do it? We'll see. Look, Bob, I'm going to be the first one. You know, nobody's going to elbow me out if this thing starts going in the wrong direction. But you know, as a matter of the good of the country.
Yeah, I got it. But before I let you go, let me just say something. You know, I just think we have to take a harder look at our history. And the fact of the matter is, yeah, you painted a nice picture of the Democrats. It was also the party of segregation in the South. I'm not going to revisit that whole history. It was a party of in many ways, racism in the North. And it was a party that got us into a lot of wars and so forth. But one thing about, you know, I'll give it to you, they generally, not always, it was Eisenhower who sent the troops to the South to enforce the Supreme Court decision about desegregation. But, you know, there is a lot of this celebration of the Democratic Party, and it's reinforced, obviously, a lesser evilism regarding Trump and the rout of the so-called moderates. They don't seem to exist in the Republican Party, and there's a lot at stake. But, you know, there's also a trap, and the trap is that one reason, by the way, that we may get some real progress on the treatment of black people by the legal system in this country is not because Joe Biden will suddenly be true to his base, because after all, he was responsible for the incarceration of a lot of black people when he was in his tough law and order stance, but because we had the Black Lives Matter movement and athletes and others joined in on it. We've had an incredible protest in the streets and elsewhere. And, you know, one reason why Democrats might have to pay attention to the growing economic misery in this country, I mean, there's astounding class division where now it's not just some isolated families living in a car as when your parents did it. But now, my goodness, you know, there's millions upon millions of people don't know how they're going to get through the next week. And the income division. Yeah. And so what I'm saying is, if we put our keep playing this electoral game and put all our eggs in that basket and then wait for the lesser evil or the supposed good guys to do it, that's where the money talks. I want to end on this, though. The money talk and what your book is about. I'm here actually trying to get people to read your book, you know, and I'll do another podcast with you when it's available, you know, for sale, which should be pretty soon. But the tale of your book that got you into, you know, your real political career when you were the mayor of Cleveland is that money controls the action in this society. And a capitalist society. And right now, it's the biggest money. You used to be upset with the Cleveland newspaper. My goodness, now we have to be thankful of that billionaires bail out the newspapers. There's no, where is journalism? We have to look for Comcast and other people to give us supposedly good journalism or Apple News. We are in very big trouble on the very thing that seemed to have motivated a lot of voters, this economy. And we don't have a free market. We have cartel capitalism with a vengeance. And that's what causes me to despair about the whole thing. Thank you, Dennis Kucinich. As always, interesting. Again, I urge people to read your book, and not to lead them to cynicism, but to understand just how ruthless power and money is. Anyway, but that's it for this edition of Sheer Intelligence. Engineer at KCRW is Christopher Ho, puts this show up. Natasha Akimi Zapata writes the introduction. Lucy Baraville does the transcription. And Joshua Shear is the producer of Sheer Intelligence and keeps it all together. See you next week with another edition of Sheer Intelligence. J'ai allumé le feu, mes chagrins, mes plaisirs, je n'ai plus besoin d'eux. Balayer les amours avec leurs trémolos, balayer pour toujours.